This is The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal Land with the full story. It's a war prosecuted like no other, with conflicting statements about the presence of peace talks from both sides. Donald Trump says they're happening, but in return, Iran has mocked the US president and denied any negotiations are taking place. Meanwhile, the fighting continues and the US is building up troops in their thousands. What in this confusing picture can anyone trust about where the war will go next? Today, global affairs correspondent Andrew Roth on whether there's any truth in Trump's talks. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to Full Story.
Hi, Regid. Thanks for having me again.
It's really good to talk to you because events are moving very quickly. The US reportedly sent a 15-point plan. We'll have a little chat about that. But how genuine are any peace talks with Iran that Trump has been claiming are being had?
It's really hard to tell at the moment. And, you know, there's a little bit of a double game being played. And it mirrors what's been happening since the beginning of this conflict. You know, on the one hand, we have seen the White House and Donald Trump come out very straightforwardly and directly and say, we're going to hold off on attacking these major power plants in Iran. In a sense, offer a kind of olive branch to the degree that you can during a war like this. And we are having good peace talks with the Iranians. This is what Donald Trump has been saying for the last couple of days. But the second that we get into anything about the details of who's leading those peace talks, when they're going to be held, what exactly is going on, that's when we end up with more questions than answers.
Trust is such an issue for the public because of the inconsistency. How can we even trust anything that Trump says at this point?
Well, it's difficult for us to trust it. I think it's difficult for the Iranians to trust it as well. I mean, considering the fact that this White House has repeatedly launched attacks during periods of negotiation, going back to last year, we know that negotiations for this White House don't always end with a peace deal. Sometimes they're more about buying time for, let's say, the White House to put other pieces on the board in place. So there's a lot of different ways and contingencies that this kind of peace deal ends up, or these peace, quote unquote, talks end up. And I think that the Iranians are rightly skeptical about who's running the peace talks in Washington, D.C., and about what exactly is being promised them.
In terms of how genuine the negotiations are or Donald Trump's comments are, some analysts have said that Trump has one eye on the markets and the oil shock when he says things that he says. Is there perhaps any truth to that?
Yeah, entirely. I agree with that. I think that judging by the timing of when a lot of these statements have come out from the White House, we see that they're timed to go public just shortly before markets open, particularly days on the market that look like they're going to be very bad for the White House. This Monday in particular was the first time that we heard publicly about these peace talks. And Donald Trump made that statement just a few hours before markets opened. And what we've seen very largely is that the White House has been able to prevent oil, prevent energy markets from really skyrocketing in a way that could really knock the U.S. out of this war, or at least raise the political cost to a really unbearable level. So this is a war that's being fought on two fronts, you'll hear often. The first front is in Iran, and the second is, you know, in the markets on Bloomberg terminals. These are the questions of what is Brent trading at? What are U.S. stocks trading at? And when are Americans going to get fed up with just how painful this little excursion, as Donald Trump calls it, gets?
I want to talk a little bit more about those peace talks from the Iranian side. So much of the senior leadership has been killed. So who could even be talking to the US in Iran? Are there any direct talks? Can we say that for sure? Are they speaking through media statements? What exactly do we know about what is going on there?
Yeah, there are several figures within the Iranian leadership who have been able to, let's say, rise up to positions of power, given the first and second levels of leadership have been decimated. One that's been very publicly stated was Mohammad Baghef Ghalibaf. He is a former IRGC commander. He fought in the war between Iran and Iraq. More recently, he had run several times for president and had been mayor of Tehran. So he's one of the heavyweights who's seen as a potential intermediary for the U.S. There are others as well, a successor to the former head of security, Ali Larijani. His successor is another person who could possibly be in communication with the U.S., but this is not happening directly. So the first key here is that these talks are being run through intermediaries in the region and not the usual suspects. The U.S. has burned through so many of those, especially Oman in this case, that what we're hearing at the moment is that the talks are being routed through other intermediaries in the region, like Pakistan, like Turkey or Egypt as well. So that's where we first heard that there might be some kind of talks taking place. But beyond that, these are suggestions of ceasefire deals that are being passed back and forth between Washington and Tehran. And based on what we've seen publicly and what we're hearing from those two different sides, it seems like the two sides are very far apart in terms of how they expect a potential ceasefire to take place.
So there was a 15-point plan reportedly covering things like nuclear capabilities, potentially lifting sanctions. Then there was a reported response with a 5-point plan from Iran. Out of all of that, what struck you as the most interesting element?
Well, I think on the U.S. side, it's in particular that there was what Iran called kind of maximalist demands from the U.S. side. The U.S. sees itself as having won this war. And every day we turn on the television and we hear Donald Trump talk about how successful they've been at eliminating levels of leadership of the Iranian regime, of decimating Iran's ability to, you know, fire missiles in the region, its navy, etc. Iran doesn't think that it's losing the war. I mean, Iran sees it as they've maintained the ability to project force throughout the region, close the Straits of Hormuz, and show defiance in the face of a month almost now of a concerted U.S. effort, joint U.S.-Israeli effort, to decimate and destroy the country. So one of the things that was most interesting about those two different plans is that both sides had kind of hardened their demands in them. When the Iranian counterproposal came back, one of the demands is that Iran be given sort of rights of navigation over the Straits of Hormuz. This is not something that had existed before. And that would give and kind of legitimize Iran's chokehold over that specific waterway throughout the world. So it's really surprising that Iran thinks that it's negotiating right now from a position of strength. As much as the White House wants to be able to end this war when it wants to, the fact is that it can't really do that without either a major escalation against Iran or Iran's agreement to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. It's pretty easy for a power of that size to be able to do that. And that gives Iran a little bit of ability to drive the conflict, to decide when it continues and when it comes to a potential end.
And in terms of Iran's response to this 15-point plan, some of the reports are around Iran being very keen that the conflict with Lebanon is included in any kind of resolution.
Right. That complicates the picture as well, because this is a multi-vector conflict that doesn't just include the U.S. and Iran. It also includes Israel and Hezbollah and Lebanon as well. And the idea that you can't just negotiate one deal with Iran, which is difficult enough, but you also have to settle a conflict between Israel and Lebanon, where we're now talking about Israel occupying territories in southern Lebanon, means that this is going to become even more complicated to all work out. So based on these kind of initial statements that both sides are putting forward, it's very hard to see how you can bring the U.S. position and the Iranian position to some kind of ceasefire deal very quickly.
Let's talk a bit more about that, especially in terms of the troop buildup. I'm wondering, do you think Donald Trump is at a fork in the road? On one hand, he could choose peace in one path, and on the other hand, keep fighting because there is a reported troop buildup happening.
Right. And we've confirmed this today, too, that the U.S. is sending troops, airborne troops from the 82nd Airborne, including members of a brigade that's sent for very quick response missions around the world. These are the kinds of troops that would be able to parachute into an airfield, take it over, and then allow other U.S. troops to land there. Marines are being deployed to the region, several thousand of them from Asia, and they'll be there later this week. Then we also have reports of special forces being flown in. And what that points us toward is that whether or not there's been a political decision about what to do, the U.S. is going to be positioning its troops for potential ground operations in the region.
What might be the plan there, especially when it comes to the U.S. potentially trying to take control of the Strait of Hormuz or trying to take control of Hag Island, Iran's oil hub?
There are a few different ideas. One is that this is a chance to take leverage from Iran. So Hag Island is Iran's oil production hub. And one idea is that the U.S. could send in troops, send in the airborne, send in Marines and other troops, take over Hag Island and basically hold it hostage and say that if you want to regain control over your oil exports, then you're going to have to open the Strait of Hormuz. So that's one idea, is to kind of force a deal by taking leverage through this operation. Another idea is that these troops will simply be sent to take coastline along Iran in order to prevent Iranian troops from targeting shipping that's going through there. So this is more of a blunt force idea, is to actually go into the country, onto the mainland, and actually try to stop troops at the point where they would attack shipping going in. You know, there are other operations these troops could take on. They might go into Iran and they might search for elements of the Iranian nuclear program that the U.S. wants to eliminate, that highly enriched uranium. I think it's about 440 kilograms that the U.S. is still searching for and attacked last year. So there are a lot of different missions that they could take on. But what we can say is that, I mean, we're really off the beaten path at this point. You know, this is uncharted territory. Within a month, we've gotten from targeted strikes on Iran to sending in troops from all these different, you know, various areas of service in the U.S. for an open-ended mission. It shows you just how quickly mission creep has taken hold here.
Do you think Trump knows what he's doing?
That is a very difficult question to answer. I think that Donald Trump is making up what he's doing on a day-by-day basis. But based on my reporting, what I can say is that it's difficult to recall or remember a U.S. operation of this size, comparable size, anything like this within the last 50 years that has taken place with so little planning on the political side of what happens next. What happens after you manage to establish the kind of military dominance that we have? We've seen that the Pentagon really knew what they were doing going into this conflict. They had years of planning, either with O plans that are, you know, sort of these off-the-shelf invasion plans that the Pentagon has in the United States, plus with targeting data, et cetera, for how they were going to defang Iran as quickly as they could. But as to all the other planning that's supposed to take place, what does the political transition look like? What is the plan for U.S. citizens in the region, which might seem like a sideshow, but is actually a key question for every, you know, U.S. administration, down to really simple questions of logistics, questions of how long this was going to take. It really feels like there wasn't the kind of planning that needed to go into this. And that's what we're seeing every day as this conflict moves forward. It feels like decisions are made the morning of.
We'll be right back. Andrew, I have to take this opportunity to ask you about Russia, because you've covered President Putin and Russia extensively, including the start of the Ukraine war. Do you see any parallels at all between President Putin when he went into Ukraine and Trump's approach to this war in Iran?
Well, it's an interesting question, just because they're the two kind of biggest conflicts we've seen recently on the world stage. You know, the one lesson I think we take away from them is that for all the messaging that comes through, the key thing to watch is when big powers move armies around that we should take notice. So there is a kind of confluence, which is that we saw the Russians move their armies to the border of Ukraine before the war took place. And despite all the messaging, all the negotiations and discussions, those armies were ultimately used. You know, you could say it's like Chekhov's gun. If it comes out in the first act, it's going to go off in the third or the fifth. In the same way, you know, if we look at the U.S. armies being moved into the Middle East, there wasn't really always a question whether or not they would eventually be used against Iran. The fact that we're seeing Marines being moved there now, the fact that we're seeing airborne troops being moved there.
And you're talking about thousands.
Right. And that's just the beginning, right? If we're compared with the Iraq landing force or the Iraq force, you know, this is much smaller. But this is just the beginning of what would be needed to exert the kind of political control that the Trump administration wants to. I do think there's a difference, though, which is that I think that Vladimir Putin had thought through the Ukraine campaign for a lot longer than Donald Trump had thought through this Iran campaign. He had a very specific, you know, almost insanely specific kind of view of how he would take over Ukraine, how he would eliminate what he would say were anti-Russian elements of Ukrainian society, recreate it. That was almost entirely a kind of political goal from the Russian side. In terms of the U.S. and Iran, I mean, it doesn't seem like there was much of a plan at all. If we look at Donald Trump on the first day of the war going on television and saying, as soon as we're finished bombing, the Iranian people should rise up and should overthrow your dictators. This is the last chance you're going to get. I mean, that was a big tell that there really wasn't a plan. There wasn't a group of people that were in the waiting. The White House did not know what they were going to do next. And that's a big difference between Russia and the U.S.
Just finally, given we're hearing that Iran might want to give the US and Israel a bloody nose before this is over, that you can teach them a bit of a lesson, they may not want to give up the control of the Strait of Hormuz. With your experience as a correspondent, when do you think this will finally be over?
It's hard to say. I think that both sides are putting up a really strong front. And one thing is that there can be chances for diplomacy, you know, behind closed doors. And it is possible that both sides are trying to say we can keep fighting forever. But that is just a kind of negotiating position. It just feels like the normal rules of geopolitics are not really at play at this point. I mean, this is a conflict that began with an assassination strike on the leader of a foreign country, of Iran, and has decimated successive levels of leadership there. If that doesn't make this an existential conflict for that country's leadership, it's hard to imagine what will. And in that case, do threats like blowing up a power plant really have as much cachet anymore, as much strength? To me, it feels like many people on the Iranian side, particularly in the leadership, think that they're in the fight for their lives. And in that case, it's hard to see this conflict ending right away.
Andrew, on that note, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Reggie.
That was Global Affairs correspondent Andrew Roth from Washington, D.C. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert, sound design and mixing by Daniel Simo, and the executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts, including on Spotify. I'm Reggie Ahmed. See you soon.